magical place we could go. So close your eyes and make a wish for the skies with the angriest, flappiest birds, and the seas with ridiculous fish. The Dutch Arcade Show is here again. It's Friday night and I'm with my friends, Eli, Jared, and Mike most of the time. Mike, come on, let's go to the Dutch Arcade Show.
Hey guys, what is up and welcome to Touch Arcade Show, episode number 402, recording live on June 6th, 2019, 50% on location at WWDC.
Yeah.
That would be me, Jared.
Major WWDC FOMO, but...
Do you?
I've had a good week at home.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like... Between me going to Digital Dragons and Nordic Game and stuff, I was just like completely dreading like being home for a day, doing laundry, repacking my bag and flying out again. So,
yeah, I don't think you missed a whole lot besides just the funness of coming to an event. But like work wise, if you were coming for work purposes, I think it might have been a little bit of a bust because I really haven't heard of any game developers being here. So
that's always sort of the problem with WWDC is because they do like the ticket lottery thing. It's like you never know who's going to be there. It was kind of interesting, like way back in the day, like WWDC, I don't know, when did we start going to that? Like 2009, 2010, something like that? And it was like before they did the ticket lottery and it was like the who's who of... iOS developers. Like it was like
it was a toss up if it was bigger than GDC or not.
Well, yeah, particularly because I almost think it was one of those years was like I think better than GDC because you could just like show up at GDC, right? Like and just kind of like hang out. GDC is like way less expensive versus like WWDC costs like $2,000.
Right.
So it was like in order to go to WWDC, you need to be like a pretty serious iOS developer kind of person, not, you know, just like someone that's like, hey, I was thinking about making a game and I came and I have the cheap pass that gets me to the 2 days of mobile stuff and I'm hanging out, you know, like, so that's bad. I mean, you're like, of course, awesome stuff has always come out of that demographic of person, but I don't know. I don't know what I'm getting at. Yeah.
That's okay. I never know what I'm getting at. Before we go too much farther, I should mention that this episode is sponsored by Armor Games and their new release, Infectinator 3 Apocalypse. We'll have a little bit more proper ad copy to read a little bit later in the show. Hopefully, Eli will slinky alert me when it's time to do that. But anyway, Infectinator 3, if you're listening to this podcast, chances are you know about it and already know that it's cool.
I would say if you're listening to this podcast and you don't already know that everything that Armor Games makes is good, I've been paying attention.
WWDC, been here this week. Nobody in our crew of people had a pass or anything, so we didn't go to the actual the conference itself. But we all kind of group watched the live stream of the keynote, which was, man, I'm just having a really hard time. I feel like the online reaction was like people thinking it was the best thing ever and then everyone else thinking it was the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and it's really weird. Really... Like this keynote particularly, like usually it seems to me that like if you check the temperature of the internet after an Apple thing, like of course you always have like the super Apple zealots that will love absolutely anything that Apple does. But like if you discount those people, it usually seems like the temperature is the same across most demographics. Like even like the hardcore like Android curmudgeons can usually be like, oh, that's pretty cool, you know, it's Apple being Apple, but that thing they announced is pretty neat kind of thing,
right?
And yeah, this time around it's like I don't know, like how split it is just bananas between I people being like, hell yeah dude, finally iPad OS and all this stuff, and other people are just like $999 monitor stand.
That was the thing that everyone latched onto with, I mean, you know, good reasoning, but I feel like Apple should have been smart enough to know that that was going to be a thing and you know, I think they could have positioned it in a different way where it's like, oh, the monitor is $6,000. And also, if you don't need a stand, there's an option that's $5,000 or something, instead of blatantly being like, this is a $1,000 stand. Because maybe people wouldn't have really noticed it and made such a big deal out of it if it was positioned that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but at the same time, like, what I can't help but wonder is, was this sort of thing like sort of intentional inside of Apple? Like, did they know that, like, so I don't know, like it's such an interesting thing because like other computer manufacturers like HP and IBM and people that are into like these hardcore, like workstation style computers release this sort of stuff all the time. And no one gives even half a shit, you know, it's just like, oh, I don't, you know, if you ask like some random person that's mad about like the Mac Pro, like, oh, have you, did you know that HP makes similar stuff? They're like, what? I don't know.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. So it's interesting to see how like obsessed people are with this like pro level stuff that no one honestly really needs.
Yeah.
Aside from the people that do need it. And like at that point, it's like, okay, if you're working for like a production studio and you just work on like $10 million projects and a $15,000 workstation times however many people are in your office allows you to render stuff out like 25% faster or whatever, and you can do more $10 million projects. And, it's like you don't even think about it. It's like, of course we're getting this. We're getting this for everyone.
Right. Well, you've probably already got like a $50,000 camera or 10, you know, like, it's just
we're like, like $150,000 like storage stuff for all your files, you know, like it's, I don't know. It's
right. But I think a lot of people just look at any Apple, anything because they're Apple and they think like, oh, everything is a consumer focused something or another, when they really specifically are targeting very niche pro, like actual pro level users.
Yeah.
And it's not really, it's kind of Apple's fault too for, you know, releasing things like the MacBook Pro that's not pro level at all. And so maybe people just think of it as like a, you know, a really good tower Mac that, you know, I want to be able to buy because it's really nice and powerful, but your average consumer doesn't need that at all. Yeah. Never will.
Well, so what's really interesting to me about this is that I'm really kind of curious who Apple really kind of identifies as like the, I don't know, like the creative sort of professional customer that they're going after with this stuff. Because like, don't get me wrong. Like there's obviously there's a massive market of people in the film industry and other, you know, worlds that require like this kind of like ultra high end computing power, you know, no matter the cost and all that stuff. But I would think that there would be a much larger demographic of like prosumer level people, as much as I hate that kind of like buzzword, like really just want an expandable Mac, you know, like that probably bought an iMac because it's just like, there's no other real thing to buy that makes sense.
Yeah.
And
you
so
know, I think that's totally true because, you know, for a long time, the previous Mac Pro that came out in 2013 or whatever it was, like a lot of people had like, wanted to pull the trigger on something that was that level, but didn't want to get like this outdated, you know, unexpandable sort of thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when they released the iMac Pro, like last year or whatever it was, a ton of people jumped on that because that was sort of like what they needed, even though it doesn't really have any expandability or anything, but like that was what they were sort of looking for. And it seemed like there is a market for that level of pro stuff that's not it where the new Mac Pro is at, you know what I mean? So something that's in the middle. So like maybe something that's like a Mac Pro, the new one, something that style, but toned down. I could see that like a mid range version.
I mean, like I
could see people wanting that.
So for me, I always kind of like when I look at Mac hardware and you know, like laptops are their own thing, obviously. So I'm just talking about desktop stuff here, but like, so the PC that I'm using right now to do this podcast, I first assembled in 2011, maybe 2012 or whatever. So inside of it right now in 2019, is the same motherboard, same processor. I ended up adding a little bit more RAM when RAM got cheaper. I got a faster hard drive, and then I've upgraded the video card a few times. But other than that, it's a computer that's 7 or 8 years old that I can still play all the newest games on and stuff. And like, that's just a normal thing with, you know, the like PC hardware. And it really bums me out that there's like not a Mac equivalent of that, because I feel like I would pay a little bit higher kind of like, you know, like entry price to get on board that sort of thing in like the Apple ecosystem, where it's like I could swap out parts and add stuff and upgrade things just as easily as I can on a PC, but have the ability to have, you know, like Mac OS and all that stuff. But you know, that product straight up does not exist. And I don't know, like everyone when they think of a product that is what they want, always seems like they mentally overinflate how big that market possibly is, you know. But
that's very true too.
I don't know, it just seems reasonable to me that that people would appreciate the flexibility of like a, you know, not ultra pro, but kind of like MacBook Pro level, pro mid-tower kind of Mac you could buy.
You know? I can see that. Just something that has PCI ports, you can add things to, like third-party video cards and stuff like that, or extra memory, or, you know, nothing crazy. But yeah, it's sort of surprising something like that doesn't exist. And now if you want it, you're off on the hook for $6,000 or whatever they start at. So
And you know, like the iMac Pro, I guess, is a good like solution for that, I guess. But then you're like locked into like, all right, well, now you can only have the exact monitor that Apple wants you to have because it's all baked in. I don't remember if they removed the ability to add RAM. I thought there was some drama with that with one of the iMacs where
I don't remember specifically either. I kind of think you can't, but I could be wrong.
And like that sort of stuff is just kind of wacky to me. And like, yeah, sure, you can, you know, like the expandability of Thunderbolt or whatever the port is called now is awesome, right? But I don't know. Like I back in the day when I had an all-in-one Mac and you had to use like SCSI and very early USB, which is like, man, that's a million years ago. Like, yeah, you could do a lot of stuff with it, but it was just like the jankiest setup imaginable that was so temperamental because you had like wires all over the place going from thing to thing. And like, if any of those like got bumped or got powered off or whatever else, like it fucked the whole thing up and your computer crashed. Yeah. And it just, I don't know, like it just doesn't, it's weirdly inelegant that Apple kind of suggests that as like, oh, well, you know, you can just buy an iMac Pro and then get this $1,000 enclosure to put a video card in if you want a faster video card. And that just seems bananas to me. So I don't know. But that being said, like if you're the demographic that needs this computer, like you're probably, you know, head over heels right now.
Yeah, I think you can breathe a legitimate finally over that one. Which is pretty cool. And like, as somebody that does not and will not ever need anything of that magnitude, it's pretty rad looking, and I would love to be able to get one, you know, if I was a millionaire or something, just to have. I would never use it to its full capacity, but that monitor especially is just badass. So I don't know, we'll see.
It's really cool. I don't know, like just the memes surrounding the monitor stand just seems so absurd to me. Like, particularly because like the way that those types of monitors are typically used in production environments, like you'll have like two or three of them, and you'll have like some kind of fucking crazy, like multi-arm setup that you don't even use the stand. So, I don't know. Like I kind of think that they should have just avoided that part of the keynote, like said the monitor starting at, you know, like $4,999. And then like, when you go to order them, it's like, all right, piece together your monitor now. Like, do you want a stand? Do you want the stand, or do you want like the Visa adapter? Do you just want the display kind of thing? Because I don't know, like the outrage surrounding that just kind of reminds me of like, I don't even know. It's like, if people just like figured out how much like a set of tires for a Porsche costs and just like randomly decided to be like super mad about that. Which I don't know. It's just like one of those things, like you never need to buy that. Like, it doesn't exist in your life. Of course it's expensive because it's not, it's targeting people that have a ton of money.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Very annoying.
The takes.
But aside from that, that product announcement. I liked everything else from WWDC. I liked a lot. Like all of the new stuff coming to macOS, I think is really cool. iOS 13 looks really good. And then they spun out the iPad OS to its own thing called iPad OS. And that I feel like was probably the biggest sea change of like things that have been needed for a really long time, because the iPad feels like its big screen is really underutilized in a lot of ways. And they're kind of taking advantage of things with, you know, all the multi-window stuff and just all these really iPad specific things that are just like make a lot of sense and really kind of make it its own thing instead of not just a bigger iPhone or whatever.
Well, particularly like the mouse support, like that's killer for me, because like I always love the idea of like, all right, I'm not going to use a computer anymore because the iPad's so good and the keyboard case for it's pretty awesome and everything else. But like the, like touching your screen to like move the cursor around and stuff like that when you're in kind of like, you know, like typing mode is so clunky and weird.
I don't even
know. So mouse support's super cool. Another huge thing that I'm kind of surprised this is not like, doesn't have more excitement surrounding it is the support for USB thumb drives, which
that's a big thing.
That seems huge to me because like, so when I get an iPad, typically I don't know. I think like most people would probably get along just fine with like 128 gig iPad or, you know, maybe even like a 64, although that seems like, you know, you probably should have more just for like photos and apps and all that stuff. But like, I always tend to go like one size bigger because it's nice to like be able to have like a ton of movies on your iPad and, you know, a bunch of podcasts and all that kind of stuff, which I really only ever use like, you know, like a small amount of time compared to like the rest of what I use my iPad for. So like, if I can just get like, you know, some like giant USB thumb drive for like $50 and avoid like the $500 upcharge between like an iPad with not a ton of space and an iPad with a ton of space, like that is like the slam dunk of slam dunks for me.
Well, I wonder too, because Apple's upcharge for increasing storage has always been really ridiculous, especially as the price of that stuff is just constantly going down. And so, you know, you can get like a, you know, 128 gig SD card for whatever it is nowadays. It's like $30 or something. Like it's not expensive. And as opposed to spending another $100 just to get 128 gigs total on your new iPad or whatever.
So like a good,
that seems crazy. If all you wanted to do is load it with movies, you can now do that on a card and just stick it right in when you need it.
Yeah. So like a good, like not garbage tier thumb drive now with USB-C and regular USB-A, that like a slidable kind of connector thing that has both on it, $40 for 256 gigs. That's and those are only going to get cheaper, like, you know? So
yeah,
it's crazy. Like, and you could, I mean, it's not like you need a huge one, you know, like people have just a shitload of USB thumb drives laying around by now. It seems like, cause they seem like you get a free one with like any dumb thing you buy these days. So like you could just have a little like baggie full of, like, oh, this is my 32 gig one that has a bunch of podcasts, and oh, this is my 128 gig one that has a ton of movies or whatever else, and just kind of like pop them in as needed. And that seems really cool.
Yeah, I think it's weird because if I've always been a buy the max size iOS device person, because I always know that I need it for all the music that I have, because I'm still a dinosaur and have actual music, and then but also all the games, those are only getting bigger in size and stuff like that. And it seems like even going up to like 256 gigs, which is the last phone I got, I feel like I hit that limit sooner than I thought I would. That seemed like it was a vast ocean. And then before you know it, it fills up, you know. But I feel like if I was going to go buy a new iPad right now, like I'd be hard pressed to want to spend another $200 or $300 to size up. Instead of just getting the smallest version and then offloading a lot of the big storage stuff to some sort of USB drive now.
Yeah. I guess I'm really curious to see like how seamless that actually is. Like for instance, if you, you know, like have like when all the apps start getting updated to support this kind of stuff, like if you have the Netflix app, can you just tell it like, oh, just download stuff to the USB drive. And then when you plug it in, it just recognizes it, or
I don't know
how that's all going to work.
The people that have been tinkering with the beta stuff, it seems like if you just load a bunch of movie files onto a drive and stick it in, you can just play them right off the drive through, I don't know, whatever, on the iPad. But it seems like pretty seamless. But when you get in stuff like Netflix, then, yeah, I don't really know.
Yeah. Another just random, like, so what I like so much about iOS 13 is it seems like Apple every few years does an update like this where it's like, all right, we're not going to add like a ton of new dumb features and all this stuff. Like we're
just going to
really refine and improve like existing dumb things on iOS. Like the ability to download any size app over LTE.
Yeah.
Is like, why has that not been in there for years? You know, like if I have like some insane, like unlimited data connection that I like never use because I'm always on Wi-Fi and I'm out and about and want to download like, you know, a Fortnite update that's a gig, and I've used like 3 gigs that month. Like, why should Apple be the one to be like, nope, got to wait till you're on Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And the way I understand how that works is that it's an option it presents you. So if something's over a certain limit, it's going to be like, hey, are you sure you want to do this? Which I feel like is the way it should always have been, because before it was just like, sorry, too big, go get Wi-Fi. And I've actually been in situations where that screwed me, where I'm like, no, I really need to download this thing. I can't find Wi-Fi right now, and I am willing to use the data, but you didn't even have the option. So yeah, that seems like a no-brainer sort of thing that should have been there for a while.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so weird to me, like, because I've had an LTE iPad and my iPhone, and like to get around that restriction, like what I do is just like tether to my iPad or tether to my iPhone, which like accomplishes the same thing. It's just one more stupid step that has always seemed really silly. So yeah, totally. I don't know. The Find My stuff seems really cool too.
That's really cool the way that it works. It's very similar to like Tile and stuff, but just knowing that you know, if somebody swipes your laptop, it doesn't even need to be online or open or unlocked or anything for you know, it to beam out its little signal, and then they kind of use everyone's iPhone to geolocate it or whatever, which is really smart too.
Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, like Tile did the same stuff with their little tracker things, but like it required, you know, someone with the Tile app on and signed up and everything else to kind of like walk by your lost keys or whatever, which I don't know. That always seemed pretty far-fetched to me that sort of thing would ever happen. Well, versus
I'd love to know the range too, because the Tile range is not great. So you have to really rely on somebody that has a Tile app walking by your stolen whatever pretty close proximity, I think. So
yeah, like I was pretty disappointed by that, actually. Like the I got a Tile to stick to the back of my Apple TV remote, which like is always getting lost in the couch. Like you have to be within like 5 feet or so of it for it to go off for me. Man. And I don't know if it's because I have an old one or I need to get the battery replaced or what, but I was like really surprised by how shitty the kind of like location stuff is on that. So I don't know. I think this is super cool though, because you know, like if you lose your AirPods or anything else, it's just kind of like, all right, well that sucks and it's gone and all this stuff. But like, there's a real hope out there now that like with this, you know, Find My stuff that you'll find it. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's cool. So like I said, I'm super stoked with, you know, I feel like it's always a good year when I feel like excited to get the new software updates. And like, oh man, I can't wait till September and they release this stuff. And I might even jump on the public betas whenever they come out like next month.
Yeah, this is like the first one that I was like, oh shit, like this is actually all the stuff I like enough that I might even just install the public beta now that, you know, when it comes out. But I don't know, we'll see. Like, how do you feel about the sign in with Apple stuff?
I love it. I am like a person who has begrudgingly goes for that Facebook option because I just got tired of always creating a new login for every dumb thing, even though it's like reasonably easy with like 1Password and stuff. But like it's still not like, I don't know, it still takes a little bit of effort, and I'm not always in the mood for that. And then that big Facebook connect button, I know, is pretty instant. And then it hooks into your Facebook and whatever, and then you just have a login for it. And so
particularly like I use that for stuff that I really don't care about, like when I'm like, you know, I'll be like looking something up on Google and like you know, the top result will be like something on Pinterest, and it's like, fuck, I don't have Pinterest. Yeah. And then it wants you to create a thing, and it's like, oh, let me just mash the Facebook buttons just so I can see this. Like,
right. Yeah, exactly.
So it'd be nice to be able to do that with the sign up with Apple stuff. But what I particularly like about this is the randomized email option.
That's
so amazing. I guess it's like super fucking cool. Like, so if you miss the keynote, like you, or you miss this detail. So when you use the sign in with Apple thing, and a person, a place or person asks for your email as part of that registration, you can choose to either give them your real email, or they can generate like a completely random, privatized email that just acts as a proxy. So they never have like your actual email address. And then when you log out of that thing or delete that connection or however they end up phrasing it, that goes away. Which is awesome.
Yeah, they really did this the right way.
Yeah. That's been like the plague of my existence of like really not liking to give my email out places because like, you know, like it seems like you never know like when your email is going to get in some other database and then like that database gets leaked and then like you just get like endless spam and all this other stuff. So like to be able to just sort of like turn that off entirely on like a system level seems pretty cool. What gives me pause about the sign in with Apple stuff is like it kind of like the policies surrounding using it seems a little eyebrow raising to where like, you know, if you have an app that uses Facebook or Google sign in or any of the other ones, like you must also support this. And I don't know if that was hyperbole from people on Twitter saying that like you must also, you're required to put the sign in with Apple thing first.
Yeah.
Or what, but that seems weird to me.
I think it's reasonable to require it to be, if you're going to have third-party sign-ins like that, I think it's reasonable that you're on iOS, that you should use iOS's system-wide, you know, standard too. But I don't know anything about like requiring it to be for the first option, anything like that. So yeah, that would be a little bit interesting to me, but it seemed like a lot of people were upset about the requirement of using it. And I don't think that's that strange at all. I mean, you're on iOS and this is now their standard thing. Yes. So of course they're going to want you to use
it. I don't know. It just like seems to me to be one of those things where it's like, I don't know why you wouldn't let the market decide that. Like, because it seems like an objectively better experience than, you know, like Facebook and sign in and all that stuff. Like particularly since it's just like baked into your iCloud account that you're already logged in on. And you would think that the experience would be so good that app developers would want to implement this anyway, because it's like, it works so good. Like, why would I not put this in there? And like, people are asking for it and everything else. So I don't know. It just seems like oddly heavy handed to me to be like, oh, and by the way, it's also required.
You
know, like that. I don't know. We'll see how it shakes out, I guess. But it just seems strange, I guess. Like, so whatever.
But that was definitely one of the parts of the keynote where I was like applauding. I was like, yes, thank you for this.
I know. And that's the thing. Like, I feel like most people that find out about these kind of like things that not only like increase your overall like data privacy, but also improve your sort of like quality of life of using your phone. Like people are going to demand that stuff out of apps. And it just kind of seems like Apple interjecting themselves is like, oh, this is required. Just kind of seems unnecessary. Because like, don't you think that like apps that don't use it will get to a point where it's like they have people being like, dude, I'm not going to sign up for your shit without the sign with Apple thing, because that's what I use.
I mean, but I do think I said this during the keynote. I was like, I think in like 5 or 10 years especially, we're going to look back and Apple's going to be really, really glad that they doubled down on the privacy stuff, because I think they're leading in that direction, or, you know, they're leading in that whole area of privacy being a big deal, whereas everyone else leaned really heavily into all the data collection stuff. And if we get to a point where that stuff starts getting heavily restricted or becomes even like illegal and stuff, then they're going to have to be scrambling to kind of figure out a way to do without it. And Apple's already there. You know what I mean? I think that's going to end up being a huge advantage for them in the future.
Yeah.
Plus it just makes me feel better.
No, it makes sense. And, you know, like particularly like, so here's the problem with kind of like the the privacy stuff is that, like, when you read about these kind of privacy issues and, like, you know, logins tracking you and websites tracking you and, like, all this stuff, yeah, like, it's usually kind of like the story seems to often be told with this kind of like fear, uncertainty, and doubt sort of,
yeah,
kind of slant to it. And we saw this a lot when that, remember that browser plugin Ghostery when that came out like 2 or 3 years ago or whatever. So I guess if you don't know what that plugin is, it's I don't know, like, for whatever reason, like, a couple of years ago, people are making like a big deal about having like your browser tracked between websites. So Ghostery comes out, it's this plugin that blocks trackers specifically. Like, it's not an ad blocker, but it's a tracker blocker. And like, which, you know, that's fine, that's cool. But the problem is with those is that I feel like they did sort of a bad job of educating people that were using it as to like, yeah, what those trackers were for and why they were there to begin with. And instead, the whole thing was just framed as like, look at all these websites spying on you, you know. And we saw that with Tetra Game. We got a few emails. I talked to a few people over Twitter and stuff, because, you know, they'd be like, oh, I download Ghostery, and like, I thought Touch Arcade was, you know, like a site that valued its readers, and you guys are running like 23 trackers. So you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And, you know, because like, when you read about that stuff, it's like, you know, you read these like really scary stories about like getting your identity stolen and like all this other stuff. But in actuality, like, the way a lot of that stuff is used is by like the way we used it on Touch Arcade was like, to do stuff like Google Analytics to see like what stories people cared about, and to kind of like serve more relevant ads so the site can make money and things like that. Like, there's absolutely nothing nefarious that we were doing with any of those. And like, when that was explained to people, they were like, okay, that seems reasonable, I guess. Yeah. But it was just like so weird that they would like come at us with like, dude, WTF 23 trackers, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. And the app analytics stuff is kind of the same way. Like, those are used to like improve products, not to, I don't know, like, you know, creep on you and steal your identity and stuff like that. So I don't know. We'll see how that shakes out. Like, hopefully there's some like good middle ground between like actually increasing privacy while still allowing developers, websites, et cetera, to have access to those tools that are super useful.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see.
Yes. We will see. But I don't know. I thought it was all very exciting stuff. And then, so moving on to gaming related WWDC stuff, the megaton announcement was that they announced PS4 and Xbox One controllers are going to be able to work with, initially they just mentioned Apple TV when they were talking about Apple Arcade. But as we've come to find out, the details since the keynote is that it's across the board with iOS and iPad OS too. So effectively, they just jump-started the whole world of controllers for gaming on mobile stuff, and kind of killed the MFI controller industry, in my opinion, because who's going to go buy any, even the best third-party MFI controller is nowhere close to an Xbox or PS4 first-party controller. So,
I completely agree.
It's open. Yeah. So I don't know. This opens up so many possibilities, because one of the big barriers, and you know, the MFI controller people that use them, a lot of them get really hardcore into playing that way and liking it the most, and that they want every game to come out to have controller support, and they won't even play games that don't have controller support and stuff like that. And so it's like there's a market of people that really love that. But then the barrier has always been like, hey, you'd probably enjoy playing more mobile games if you had physical controls. Go buy this $50 plus sort of janky controller to use. And you know, that's like a huge barrier for a lot of people. Nobody was really doing that. But when you say like, hey, that game console you already have, the controller works with your iPhone and iPad and Apple TV now. So you should try it out. Like, oh, hell yeah, I'm going to try that out. You know what I mean? Especially with like so many ports and stuff coming over too. And then Apple Arcade, which I feel like is the catalyst for all this becoming a thing finally, is going to be a big deal, because most of those games I think are going to have controller support. and especially with them being on Apple TV and Mac too, that's going to be a huge deal. So now it's like, you don't have to really go buy this extra thing. You probably have one around if you have a game console. And if you don't, it's a lot easier to be like, hey, go spend $60 on an Xbox or a PS4 controller that's really good quality and works really well, and I can totally vouch for it, as opposed to go spend that same amount of money on this weird third-party thing that feels like a shitty toy.
No, I completely agree. So also, we're at the time to read the ad. So before I provide you my rebuttal, why don't we talk about how amazing Armor Games is.
As you wait with bated breath, let me bring you a word from our sponsor and read you their ad copy here. So Infectinator 3 is a game where you get to control a zombie horde. Create, mutate, and unleash undead minions to destroy the human race with your evil plague. Cause chaos and catastrophe with customizable zombies and a powerful arsenal of tricks and traps. Beware, though, they fight back. Humanity seeks a cure, and if that happens, it's game over. The next title in the popular Infectinator franchise is available now on all your iOS devices. Download it for $4.99 on the App Store today. Well, I guess that went reasonably well.
There you go.
That's a kind of a, they have some tongue twister verbiage in there. But yeah, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Infectinator 3, if you've been mobile gaming for a while, you probably remember the Infectinator games. They're all really fun. And this is their newest one that actually came out on Steam like a year ago. And it's paid. So the previous games were all free to play, which kind of made sense. They actually tried to go the paid route with this one. And they have since now ported it to iOS, and it's $4.99, and no in-app purchases or anything like that. So I feel you are one of those people that has the freemium fatigue that we've been talking about, this is a cool game to pick up and check out, because it's kind of the same Infectinator, you know, infect people to become zombies sort of gameplay that we loved about the previous games, but it's actually fully paid and stuff too. So pretty cool.
Yeah, Armor Games makes really good stuff. We have a review
up on the site too.
Yeah, they
pretty much anything from Armor is awesome. But.
Yeah, we have a one of their older games in Game Club that we have not announced yet. So huge fans of the Armor Games guys.
Teaser.
All aboard.
Also, just as an aside too, they in talking to them, you know, leading up to the release of this game and stuff, because I saw it at GDC and stuff, and talked to the Armor guys there. Yeah, they're really like wanting paid games to still be working. Yeah. And this is kind of like a last stab, hope this works out, sort of release a paid game and hope it still works type thing. So yeah, if you like the Infectinator games and haven't picked this one up yet, but you like premium gaming and want to see it succeed, picking up this game would probably be a good thing to kind of put your money where your mouth is.
I
don't know. We'll see if it works out for them. I'd be sad if it didn't.
Yeah, me too. Actually, I got, lunch or breakfast or something with the Armor Games guys at GDC at, what's the burger place right there? Super Duper Burger, right?
Yeah.
So did you know that there's two Super Duper Burgers within like 600 feet of each other?
I did know that. Did you guys go to the different ones?
Yeah, it was like so crazy. You're like texting each other, being like, dude, I am upstairs in the corner at a table by myself. There's no one here. And they're like,
how do you not see me?
Yeah. Too. Yeah, how do you not see me? And I was like,
that's funny.
Am I in like some Splinter universe?
No, when I got to GDC this year, that was the first place I went to get lunch because I was like starving. And it was like right when Arn was getting in town and wanting to meet up. So I just texted him like, yeah, I'm in Super Duper Burger. Not thinking, oh crap, there's another one like a block away. I hope he doesn't go to that one. And he ended up going to the right one anyway.
Because it's oh, I'm at this Super Duper Burger by Moscone. It's like, okay, flip a coin because there's two.
Right. Well, you think, you know, something like a Starbucks, like we'd always laugh because there was a Starbucks like across the street from each other for a long time that were always both packed. And you sort of, that makes a little more sense with a Starbucks, I guess. But then you think like a burger place. But both those Super Duper Burgers are always packed too. So I guess I guess they can support it. But yeah. Pretty funny.
But anyway, my take on the controller stuff is like, God, yes. About fucking time. I mean, like, Jesus.
Yeah, totally.
It kind of bums me out that they only are just now doing this now out of what seems like a necessity for Apple Arcade to be a thing, because like
Right.
Just imagine how different the history of iOS gaming would have gone if, like, from the get go, it was just like, oh yeah, just, you know, pair whatever Bluetooth controller you got. It all works. Like, no big deal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because, like, looking through the history of iPhone and iPad controllers, it was like, you know, we started with the iCade, which was like reverse engineer side load bullshit. Yeah. That's like pretending to be a USB keyboard that developers like then needed to like map in keyboard support for their games. And then like some non iCade stuff came out that was like almost the same iCade spec, but it was like the buttons were reversed or something like that. So that it was like you got really messy area of like all these controllers that like, yeah, sure, they worked and it was fine. It was cool to have like, you know, physical controls on a iOS game, but I don't know, like that was so jank. And then the MFI stuff came along and the first generation MFI controllers were like also super jank, like particularly because like Apple released multiple specs. You remember it was like the,
yes,
I don't remember what they called it. It was like the standard or and the standard extended.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Which kind of like created like an even bigger problem because it was like, not only did developers kind of need to figure out like, okay, well, do I need to build my game with like trigger support in mind and like the other, like the right analog stick and all this stuff, or is that not going to be the dominant format? So if I like build a game that takes that in mind, like is no one going to have the enhanced controller? And so create this like really weird time where it was like developers kind of like half supported both standards. And I don't know, like admittedly there were a couple of cool like standard, you know, like MFI standard controller options, like the Logitech one that was like a case. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But like ultimately like that whole thing just like sort of failed, except for like the SteelSeries controllers seem to always be the best. And there are a couple other manufacturers, like most recently, like the Rotor Riot people came out with a decent controller, I guess. And you have the what's the one that like you clamp your iPad in the middle? Game Vice.
The Game Vice,
which, like, I don't know, those are all like okay, but it always felt like when we were writing about them that like you had to always give the caveat of like, okay, like this is a $100 controller, it's more expensive than an Xbox controller, more expensive than a PS4 controller, like the build quality doesn't feel as good, but like inside of the ecosystem of MFI controllers, like this is the best one, kind of thing. Like that just always seemed like you had to have that sentence in like anything to do with MFI controllers, which just always seemed really odd when like the whole idea behind the certification process was like Apple ensuring that these things are as good as they can be and like work and everything else. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Didn't pan out.
It is silly. And I would love to know the thinking originally behind having two different MFI specs, because I can't see that being anything but a bad thing. Like, we've said this before where it's like they figured out game controllers. Like, they don't change a whole lot anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have enough buttons. They're the right, you know, shapes and stuff like that. So you're not really going to see, I don't think, a whole lot of changes going forward. And it's nice that it's kind of like a standard thing, you know, between like PC games and the consoles and stuff. Like, they all have the pretty much the same amount of buttons and functionality and things like that. And so when they first announced MFI controllers, and it's like, here's this one that doesn't have analog sticks and it has less buttons. And so if you pick that one up, you're going to at some point be pissed off when you think there's a game that has controller support that actually can, you know, supports the other extended controller that you don't have. So I don't feel like who is that serving in the first place? Why didn't you just say like, hey, we're going to be like every other console and PC controller out there and have the same amount of buttons, same amount of functionality. We just want to be like them. And oh, by the way, we're going to open it up so official controllers from these huge, game companies, Xbox and Sony, can use their controllers too. And that would have just been like a lightning rod of like, awesome. Now we all have controller support. We are all on like the same playing field. And it would have really, I think, gone a long way in making gaming on mobile be what it's appearing to start to to end up being now with all the stuff coming out now.
Yeah, it's but it would have like been really 5 years ago. Weird. So. Yeah, no, exactly. Like it's really weird to me always that like Apple didn't support Bluetooth controllers, and like the argument that I always saw sort of posed was like, well, you know, Bluetooth controllers come in like a lot of shapes and sizes and layouts, and like, you know, you can't have a standardized thing if anyone can just buy whatever controller they want. But at the same time, like, I feel like Apple could have always done, and I'm sure that you're kind of like, you've seen this in kind of the emulation stuff that you've done. Like a lot of the, like, you know, homebrew emulator things have these really good kind of like, onboarding experience. I don't know what the right way to put it, but like when you connect a controller, it's like, okay, cool. Yeah. You know, to use this as a, you know, like Super Nintendo controller, we need to map up, down, left, right, start, select, you know, all the face buttons and the two shoulder buttons. So like you go through and it's like, okay, press up, press down, plus left, press right, press A, press B, plus, you know, and like, it doesn't matter if you, you know, have a controller that looks like the Super Nintendo controller in that regard, or like if you have a fucking like Dance Dance Revolution pad set up, like, you know, however you want to play the game. Like play the game, like it doesn't matter. Like it's fine. And
that's,
and I always said
that's
that,
a thing. And sorry,
what? Oh, sorry. I always thought that Apple could have done that, like sort of like onboarding experience, like really, really well.
Yeah,
you know,
no, they could have. And that's a thing in every major emulator too. Is like easily remapping your buttons. It's not a big deal at all. But also over the decades. It's not a big deal. There's like configuration files for like basically any type of controller that's out there, because it's not a big deal to have like a tiny little text file that has like a specific brand or set up for a certain controller or whatever. So more often than not, any controller you're going to use, you're going to plug in to use with like an emulator or something. It's going to know what it is. It's going to know how to set it up and use it right or whatever. But also if you want to change any of that at any time, you can either on a system-wide, you know, basis or like specific emulator basis or whatever. So I don't think it would have been a big deal to have a settings in the settings app on iOS that's like, hey, map your control whenever any person, you know, connected. This is the way you'll have it set up or whatever. So yeah, I don't think that the standardized and certification thing was super necessary either. But
yeah, no, I mean, it like always seemed crazy too, how like when you talk to developers, you know, I'd be like, hey, you know, I don't know if you saw, there was a bunch of people on the Touch Arcade forums that really want you to have controller support. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's cool. But like, you know, we got to like pick our battles with where we put our development resources, because we're like a 3-person studio. And like, even though adding MFI is, you know, a reasonably simple process, like those man hours could have gone into like more content or other stuff like that. And it never made a ton of sense for developers to do that when like the sales for the MFI controllers were comparatively so low, which always just really sort of bummed me out about the whole thing.
Yeah. So it's funny, cause it never really occurred to me, you know, thinking about ways that they can fix this. And I would always come back to the idea of like, man, I sure hope Apple makes their own controller, because you know, the build quality would be good and you know, it would work right and blah, blah, blah. But like the even easier solution is what they did, just being like, use Xbox or PS4 controllers. They're good. They're standard. We trust these companies to, you know, whatever, use our stuff, certify them or whatever. That's just like a, it just fixes so many problems with such a simple solution that it makes it even more aggravating that it didn't happen before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like all they had to do is add the, kind of, I don't remember the name for the Bluetooth profile, the human interface device controller profile or whatever. Yeah. And like absolutely every stupid Bluetooth controller, including like the old Wiimote, would just like connect to the iPad or whatever. And I don't know. It just seemed so like really weirdly quintessential Apple to have not done that. And like, I don't know, like what kind of sucks about this is it seems a lot like Apple Arcade in that like yes, this is a super cool thing that Apple's doing, just like Apple Arcade and all this stuff, but it was like they waited so long to do it that it's kind of questionable like how much of an impact it's going to have versus like if when mobile gaming was like, you know, operating on like all 12 cylinders and like anyone cool was making a game on mobile and stuff, that you had like you know, complete controller support and initiatives like Apple Arcade and like all this other stuff. Like, I don't know. It just bums me out because mobile would be so different. Like, it wouldn't be the way it is now. So I don't know. Whatever.
If anything, though, we're definitely seeing diversification and, you know, platforms and stuff where gaming's going.
Yeah.
And I guess that could lead into talking about Stadia, which just had a big event today.
Oh, yeah.
Unveiling all of their stuff.
So do you want to give the Stadia deets or shall I?
Feel free.
So I'm kind of fuzzy on some of the more specifics, but like Stadia, which I've been pronouncing Stadia for the longest time, but Stadia like had its whole thing revealed today, and it's basically the Founders Edition, which is like, I guess like version 1.0 of the hardware is, I guess what seems like a souped up Chromecast with a controller that you plug into your TV. And then it's kind of like a on live style experience where the game is rendered remotely, and you, you know, you're beaming up your controller inputs. The game's being rendered wherever Google's, you know, local server farms are, and then beamed back down to your Chromecast to apparently be playable with low enough latency that it's not noticeable that it's being streamed. But I don't know. So the Founders Edition pack of Google Stadia, which is the Chromecast thing and I guess the wires to plug it in and the controller, $130 to get started. I think it comes with a few free months of service, but after that, you'll need to actually subscribe for access for $10 a month.
Yeah,
which seems kind of wild to me that. Yeah. Like, so what I don't know what the answer to this question is. And I've seen a lot of people kind of like posing this in different ways, but like, so the $10 a month thing gets you access to some old games, but like when new games come out, like, do I still need to pay? Like, do I get access to those for $10 a month as well? Like, is it like Microsoft Game Pass, or do I need to buy the new game for $60 or whatever? And then if I do that, do I still need to pay the $10 a month to like access playing it?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's like a bunch of weird stuff.
Yeah. I don't totally understand that either. And what I heard, which doesn't sound right, but is that you can, you pay the subscription and you can access all the games like a Game Pass, but you can also individually buy games and like own them outright or whatever.
Yeah.
And so for a streaming platform, I don't know how that works, because I don't think it's going to install anything on anything, which it can't on most of the mobile devices. But also when you play on a desktop, it's streaming through Chrome. So it's not like, I don't know where it would install something and run it like a normal program. I don't really know how that's going to work, but
yeah, it's, I don't know. It's interesting. Like, so the way that I guess I see this working maybe long-term is like, if Google is able to kind of like have enough of these different like server farms around the United States, or around the world, that like everyone's able to get that experience. That's just like having the game rendered locally. And because it's being rendered remotely, like it just works on everything from like, you know, your old iPad to your MacBook Air with no graphics card in it to, you know, your TV or your gaming PC or whatever else. Like that seems pretty neat to me. And I like the idea of a future where it's like, I don't need to spend, you know, anywhere between like $500 to $1,000 every couple of years to upgrade my video card and my computer, because Google's just rendering those games for me. Like that seems neat, but I don't know. Like I got burnt pretty hard by OnLive, because I had bought a few games from there being like, oh, this is really cool. And I like that I can play these games anywhere. I don't need to worry about installing anything or any hardware, or anything else like that. And then, you know, when it went offline, like the most you got was like a sorry, you can't play your shit anymore. So I don't know. I'm cautiously optimistic that this sort of thing could be cool, but I completely understand everyone that's had like these extremely like cynical and pessimistic takes about how like, oh, this isn't going to last more than a couple years, you know, all this stuff. Like
we'll see. I guess at least Google has deep enough pockets that it can force it to keep going, even if it doesn't take off right away. And sometimes that's the solution to getting something to actually, you know, become a thing. Whereas I don't think OnLive had that luxury. But no. I also feel like this next generation of consoles is going to be sort of a weird hodgepodge of everyone trying to figure out the best way to go about this sort of like future way of gaming that's not sticking a physical media into a console. And it's going to be interesting to kind of see who gets it right, or what direction, you know, consumers end up accepting or whatever. Because everyone's got their, you know, poker in this fire right now, but nothing's really sorted. And I think it's going to be at least another console generation, which is like the next 5 years or so before we know for sure, like, what's going to be like the standard future of how this is going to work.
Yeah, I don't know how this is all going to shake out, because like the streaming stuff does seem pretty cool, and it like solves a lot of, like, I don't know. It solves problems, but it also creates a ton more. So like, you know, the latency issue is always going to be a thing, because like, you know, you're limited by effectively like the speed of light, more or less. So I don't know how that's going to pan out. And like, I think the most realistic cynical take that I read today was these tech companies just like need to spend money, because like, you know, if they write it off as like, oh yeah, this is R&D or whatever else, like you're not taxed on that money. And, you know, like that's kind of what Amazon does. That's why Amazon pays no tax and shit, because like they're constantly getting into other projects and stuff. So like they don't technically have, you know, like in air quotes, like profit to be taxed. And there's an argument to be made that like Google could be in a similar situation where it's like, well, fuck, like we're making all this money. Like what kind of crazy projects can we spin up just to kind of like see what happens with them? And, you know, go from there. And it's like, it's one of those things. I mean, it's like, it seems like a weird comparison to make, I guess, but like when you look at like the Apollo program and like us going to the moon and all that stuff, like, yeah, the goal was to get to the moon and like, you know, build these rockets and send, you know, send humans into space and all this stuff. But like, as part of that research and development of like making all those things, like all these other technologies were created as part of that. So maybe there's a future where like Google Stadia is like this stupid thing that like no one really uses, but as part of that, you know, insane investment in all this tech that Google makes, like they stumble across like, oh, hey, this is actually like a new network protocol that works way better for this sort of stuff. And it's going to have like all these other uses that isn't streaming games or all this other stuff. So I don't know. Right. It's, I guess we'll see what happens. I don't know. I pre-ordered the Founders thing, cause I really liked OnLive and I think that this stuff has potential and we'll see.
That's cool.
I guess.
Yeah. I'm content to sit on sidelines and see what happens with everything first. Cause I'm not really in a spot anymore in my life where I'm like need to be on the cutting edge of all the gaming stuff. It's fun. You know what I mean? But like, you know, if I got in on day one on something like this, it'd be a cool thing for a few days. And then I would probably never play it again.
The reason I did it is because I feel like it's going to be, what was it? The 3DS they released, or the Wii U or something like that, where Nintendo they ended up doing like that ambassador program where like everyone got a ton of free shit that I bought early because like it sucked so much. Like that was kind of like
made me.
Like, you know, so you're talking about like that was what I was thinking when I was like, oh, I'll pre-order one of these because I'm sure it'll have all sorts of issues and I'll probably get a ton of free shit, you know, from like Google apologizing and all this stuff. So like, I don't know, I spent more money on dumber stuff. So
I was super jealous that I wasn't one of those lucky people that got to pay more for a 3DS before the price drop and then get all those cool Super Nintendo games. So I guess that's not a bad strategy.
it is very stupid though. So, you know, for whatever that's worth, I don't know.
So bouncing back to WWDC, another thing they showed off that was kind of gaming related was they showed off Minecraft Earth.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember, they were teasing something about this a couple weeks ago, and then they released a little trailer, and it sort of showed what it was, but not really. Everyone sort of looked like, you know, was sort of speculating it's like a Pokemon Go, but with Minecraft, which I think is largely true. But I think that's just one component of this. And then the other component is a like a local multiplayer, like Minecraft building thing that you can do in AR, which is what they demoed during the keynote. And it's actually kind of awesome. So we've all seen the AR demos that they've done and stuff like this before, where there's like a perfectly flat and square like countertop. And then they do the projection of whatever, the castle or something, onto it. And then there's people kind of walking around it playing AR games with the projected castle on this table or whatever. And so, like, I mean, like, those are always neat tech demos and stuff like that. But especially when ARKit first came out and we were kind of like, you know, covering more AR gaming stuff because it's just a big new thing. I never found anything where I was like, this is like objectively better and more fun than just sitting on my ass and playing a game. You know what I mean? Like, it was never, it was more of just like a pain in the ass and more of like just a neat tech demo than it was like a fun gaming experience. And so when they first started out this demo, I was like, okay, well, here we go. You're going to project Minecraft onto a countertop and that's that. And like, I don't really see the appeal of that or whatever. But what was really cool is there's a way they can expand it. And now with ARKit 3, there's these two technologies, specifically that kind of help with this sort of thing called people occlusion, which that is basically like the device recognizing there's a person in the scene.
And yeah, then it worked okay, you know, too. Projecting. It wasn't like amazing, but it seemed like I was like, oh, that's impressive how well it seems to work.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like early, like blue screen sort of technology jankiness, but, it actually worked reasonably well. And so the people occlusion recognizes people and takes them into account when it's like projecting stuff in AR so that, you can like walk around the virtual objects and they'll be projected in front of you or behind you based on your position or whatever. It's kind of like creating a 3D space, sort of like VR, and objects in that space. And then, the other cool technology that's part of ARKit 3 is the, motion capture stuff, which is like super funny when you think about motion capture. If you're into gaming, that's a term that you've known about for like 30 years, because that's been a big thing to, you know, especially with sports games and stuff like that, like motion capturing athletes and Tony Hawk or Mortal Kombat really kicked off motion capture. So capturing human movements and then using them for animations for in-game characters has been what motion capture has been all about. And it used to be like a really big thing. Like you had to put on the special suit with all the little sensor balls on it and have to have like a reasonably big like area to kind of capture it with all the different cameras and do all this stuff. And it was kind of like a big to do. And nowadays you look at it and it's like, oh yeah, my phone, I can hold it up and you can do movements and it's motion capturing you and translating that into digital form inside a game or whatever, like on the fly, which I think is kind of mind blowing.
I mean, so, that was a wildly expensive thing for studios to get. Yeah. I remember when I had a friend that worked at Phosphor Games in Chicago, and like seeing the motion cap setup was like, oh shit, like this is really, really, really cool. Like seeing one of these, because they were just like unattainably expensive for anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now that's just all in your phone now. And it's really cool. So like Minecraft Earth takes advantage of that. It'll actually, if you say you're playing with a friend and they hold their device up to you, and then you can choose to like beam yourself into the game, and it'll make a little Minecraft avatar, like based on whatever your outfit is or in-game items or whatever. But then you can actually move around and it'll motion capture your motions, and your in-game avatar will like mimic that. And so you can like, I don't know, that's just another layer of cool immersion being into the Minecraft world or whatever. But, so yeah, so they did this countertop demo, and then they basically blew it up into life size so that this castle or whatever structure they were building, they were now in it like one-to-one sizing with the stuff in AR, so that, you know, it's like you're in the castle you just built in Minecraft, which is like a trip to me. And when I think about how popular Minecraft has been, I remember like seeing a really eye-opening demo of you know, some of my friends that have older kids were kind of all hanging out together. And it was like, one of them was playing Minecraft on a desktop Mac. One of them had their iPad. Another one had like an iPhone. And then another one had like a different device, like a Switch or something. But they were like all playing Minecraft together, all on these different devices. And they were just having like the time of their lives in game together. And so when you see about how popular that sort of stuff is, and then you think of like, you know, expanding that to like this AR environment that surrounds you where you're like inside the things you're building with your friends and stuff. Like, I think that's super powerful and it's going to be just a huge deal. So it's pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah. Like, so for me, so two things on this, like I'm very curious to see how this game actually plays outside of demos, because I think that like the way that I would like to see it work is like a truly kind of like collaborative building experience, kind of like to sort of like recreate the magic of Pokemon Go, where it's like, you know, maybe you hear like, oh shit, like this park near me, like people have built this absolutely insane thing. Like you got to go check it out and like add to it or whatever else. So like those, structures are like locked in one place, but like with the scalability of it, like, I don't know if that is how it's going to be. Like, wouldn't it be neat if you like went to the park and it was like, oh shit, dude, someone spent like days building this insanely huge castle that just like towers over the entire neighborhood, and you have to like go to the park and see it in AR, kind of thing like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That to me seems really cool. But secondly, like, I think, you know, a lot of people have been kind of including myself, kind of like negative about these AR games, because like so often, like it doesn't, like the AR stuff rarely seems like it adds to the experience. Like more often than not, it feels like games that are like have AR stuff, it's like, all right, well, you know, this would be just as good if I wasn't like, if I could control this in like a different way, that's not, you know, holding my iPad around like an idiot kind of thing.
Right.
But kind of like the farther Apple goes down this path, like the more and more it seems completely apparent that like what they're building towards is some kind of like Magic Leap style headset sort of thing. And then like when that exists, and then they can be like, oh, you know, by the way, we've got like 10,000 cool AR things that just like work straight out of the box and are now even better with your Apple glasses or whatever. That to me seems like it's just going to be like the aha moment for most people on augmented reality. Because like, if you
I can definitely see that being the case.
Yeah. Like imagine your typical like AR experience, but instead of like, you know, so my Minecraft example where you're like going to the park and seeing this crazy castle this guy built, like if you, you know, and having to like look at it through like the 5-inch screen of your phone or whatever, if you just had like, you know, the Apple glasses on and you were just like driving by and you looked over and you're like, oh fuck, like that's super duper cool what this guy built there. Like that, that to me seems amazing to think of as a possible reality.
And then you wreck your car.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so I don't know. That's that, all that stuff is pretty exciting for me. So I guess we'll see what happens.
Yes. To that first point though, like, you know, somebody building something crazy at the park down from your house or whatever. If you've ever looked up like videos on crazy Minecraft builds and stuff, and like, you know, somebody recreated all of Hogwarts in, you know, life scale to inside Minecraft or whatever, or like somebody recreated the Millennium Falcon and you can go around and walk in and walk around it and stuff like that. Like that sort of stuff would translate super well to like an AR experience where you can actually see it in front of you or whatever. I can see that being a really cool thing.
It's interesting though, thinking about like the impact of this kind of stuff, like long-term, and I don't want to spoil anything, but like if you, so the new season of Black Mirror just came out and the first episode kind of like deals with the sort of like social consequences of like addiction to virtual reality, I guess is the least spoilery way I can put it. And like, and I really think like that sort of thing, as these experiences, both augmented reality and virtual reality, like get better and better, is going to be like a real deal thing that is going to be like the next big social problem of people that like imagine if your life just like sort of sucks or like whatever else, which I guess is like kind of like the premise of Ready Player One, right? Where it's just like, who even cares about like, you know, what's going on in the real world? Like, we can just veg out in VR all day and have an experience that's like 300 times better than your actual life.
Right.
So I don't know. It's something to get drunk and think about.
The trip. We're just one step closer to the Matrix. It's all basically coming true.
Yeah.
How are we doing on time?
We're running kind of long. I was just going to tell you, if you want to wrap this up, we can do that.
Cool. Yeah. I think we hit all the major major things I want to talk about with the WWDC and everything. So as always, thanks everyone for listening to this week's episode. And once again, it was sponsored by Armor Games and their new release, Infectinator 3 Apocalypse, which is out on iOS for $4.99 right now. If you like Touch Arcade and everything we're doing with mobile gaming, then definitely check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/touch arcade. We are primarily supported through our support on through our Patreons on Patreon. So thank you very much for that, and consider giving us a little bit of support through there. You'd normally be getting a video version of this podcast, but since we're on location, it kind of didn't work out that way. So should be back to normal by next week, and I'll have some exclusive baby Anthony photos for our Patreon backers.
There you go.
In addition to that, you could help us out by doing your Amazon shopping through toucharcade.com/Amazon. And we'll get a tiny slice of anything you'd be buying through Amazon anyway. And collectively, that can go a long ways towards making the site continue to exist, which is all we really want in life, is to continue to exist.
Hell yeah.
So with all that, thank you very much for listening. And we will be back with another episode of the Touch Arcade Show next week.